Sunday, October the 26th.
Welcome to this Burlington Audio Podcast. We hope you will be encouraged and inspired in your faith as you listen to this message. We'd love to hear what you think. Please be in touch with us through the website. More information and many more podcasts are all at burlingtonbaptist.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
Great. Genesis chapter 3. Here we go. To put it in a bit of its context, we're thinking about these early chapters, these early verses in the scriptures. Chapters 1 to 11 of Genesis is kind of a group of writings that set the scene, set the stage, if you like, for the whole thing. And so we're trying to understand what are the key principles, the key understandings that we need from which everything else flows. That's why we're calling it the beginning of everything. And just as an aside, if you haven't been around for the last few, it's super easy for us to ask all the wrong questions about these verses. It's not that the questions aren't important, they're just not the most important questions. So, for example, we want to know whether Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2 are scientific accounts of the beginning of the world. They're not. And whatever we might deduce from them in terms of our understanding about the way that the world was made, we must assume that they weren't trying to answer our 21st century Western questions, because they weren't. That's not to say it won't shed any light on those questions. It's just to remind ourselves that that's not the question that they were asking, and it's not the issue that they are trying to address. And the same is true with the story of all the stories in these first 11 chapters. Whatever we might spend our time debating, So you have all kinds of debates around the nature of Noah's flood and the ark and all of that. They're not bad or wrong questions. It's just not what the writer was trying to explain in telling us those stories. So as we look at Genesis chapter 3, we can get lost in, was there a Garden of Eden and where was it? And did the world just begin with two people, Adam and Eve, or is the story more complicated than that? Those are really interesting questions, but the Bible wasn't trying to answer them. And so we want to step back and ask, what are the things that these verses are trying to teach us? What is it that God in his wisdom thinks that we need to understand about the beginning of everything? And last time in chapter 2, we reminded ourselves that we as human beings were handmade. There is something very precious, something very potent about something that is handmade. If you want something cheap, you manufacture it and you get loads of things that are the same. If you're going to spend a bit more money, you're going to get something that's bespoke. If you want something that, or you want to spend even more money, you might get something that's unique. And at the top of that which is unique are those things that are handmade because they can't be reproduced. So certain paintings, usually the ones that I've drawn or painted, are priceless because they cannot be repeated. There is something utterly unique about them, and the Bible says that each one of us is unique, so there is something priceless about each one of us. We are handmade. And so we used four words a couple of weeks ago to help us navigate our way through Genesis chapter 2. Who can remember one of the four words? Dignity was one. Thank you, Alice. Whew. Design, thank you, Helen. Dependence, thank you, Francis. And for the $6 million prize, the final word was destiny. Destiny. You all knew that. You were just giving other people a chance. Well done. We're going to use four more words to help navigate us through chapter 3 together. I'd love you to have it open in front of you. I'm going to rely on you reading more from the text in front of you rather than it just being on the screen to help us be actively engaged rather than passive receivers. The big issue is this, though, that chapter 2 comes before chapter 3. So the truth, the foundation, is that we are unique and priceless and beautiful and wonderfully designed. That's the first thing we need to understand about each other before we think about how we're marred and broken and wounded and hurt and disobedient and all the things that chapter 3 brings us. We need, when we look at one another, and even when we look at ourselves, need to remind ourselves that chapter 1 and 2 is the foundation, is what's ultimately true, and chapters 3 onwards is how that which is true has been marred or broken, not that it's no longer true. So a masterpiece, if it got damaged, would still be a masterpiece. And they would try and restore the masterpiece, not throw it out because it had been damaged. And so we need to understand the order that our beauty comes before our brokenness, that our design comes before our destruction, that the image of God in us before the imprint of sin. What the church has sometimes done, particularly in history, is to concentrate on our brokenness and our disobedience. It's been a big thing in the church historically. We focus on the punishments and the things that are wrong and all the rest of it. And you don't need to go very far into church history to find examples of that. And there's this wonderful phrase that came out of the Reformation, total depravity. Have you heard that phrase before? Like everything about you is utterly awful. Yes, exactly, joy. And whole doctrines have been built up on that. And the problem with that is that if we're not careful, it eclipses chapters 1 and 2, that there is a beauty and a design and a uniqueness and a preciousness about us. So even as we enter chapter 3, we don't want to lose all that we've thought about already. So here we go. Four words. Deception, desire, damage, and deliverance. Deception, desire, damage, and deliverance. If you write those down, then when I ask you in a couple of weeks what they were, you would find it very easy to say what they were. Deception, desire, damage, and deliverance. Let's go. Hope you have it open in front of you. Deception, the voice that twists truth. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" What was the first sin? Hello? Disobeying was the action. What was the very first sin of human beings? You could argue it was a snake. Sorry? You're getting close, listening, the wrong. That effectively, they believed a lie. Everything began because they believed a lie. If they'd said to the serpent, "That's rubbish," chapter 3 wouldn't have been written the way that it was. Every action, behavior, comes from where? It comes from deeper within. It comes from a thought process and a feeling, a heart-held truth. The first sin was not an action. It ended up in an action, eating the apple and so on. But the beginnings of that, what led to that, was not the action didn't come from nowhere. You with me? The action came out of a belief that maybe the serpent was onto something and maybe he was right. The first sin was believing a lie. Have you noticed that the enemy's lies usually always begin with a question? The question mark is the enemy's favorite bit of punctuation. Are you sure they want to be your friend? You're probably not holy enough for God to answer your prayers, are you? Can you really be confident that God loves you after that happened in your life? You with me? If it was a blatant lie, and that's the second thing about the way the enemy lies to us, is it's cloaked in a kind of truth. Did God really say you couldn't eat from the trees in the garden? Well, no, he didn't say that, but he did say something about not eating something in the garden. So there's an element of truth. It has a respectability. It has the kind of sound of truth, a bit like your email scams that sound good. Otherwise, you wouldn't have fallen for it. If it was headed, "This is an email scam," you probably wouldn't have responded. But it sounded plausible when the bank rings you up and says something about a transaction that throws you off guard. It sounds like it could be plausible. It's not the bank at all, of course. But it has the appearance of being true in some measure, but it sows the seed of doubt. The enemy doesn't need you to believe in a lie, hook, line, and sinker, just enough to doubt it a little. Did God really say? So lies, they always start with a question. Lies are so often cloaked in truth, and they usually always come in a whisper. In a whisper. The snake sidles up to Adam and Eve. Did God really say? If it comes in the normal daylight, in normal conversation, you can see a lie coming, can't you? You go, "No, that's not true." But it sneaks up on you. It whispers to you rather than shouts with all its slippery deception. Lies always lead to loss. And notice here what the lie is beginning to do. It's already beginning to infect their hearts. Lies don't ultimately live in the head. Lies settle in the heart. The belief system isn't just about our minds. It's also about what goes on at the deeper places of our lives. "Truly I tell you," said Jesus, "if anyone says to this mountain, 'Go throw yourself into the sea,' and does not doubt in their heart," not in their mind, does not doubt in their heart. You see, truth and lies dwell ultimately in our hearts, which is why the psalmist says that God desires truth in our inner parts, in our heart place. And so we see this deception, this voice that twists the truth, beginning to dwell in their hearts. You see, because the lie is not about what you think, it is about what you feel. So if I say to you, "Do you believe that God's always with you?" What will you say? Yes. That's your head, yeah? Yeah, you know that. If I say, "Have you ever felt on your own?" What would you say? Yes. Oh, hang about. How double-minded is that, to use the phrase from James? We think something, but in our hearts, we harbor a different story. Lies rest in our hearts, a deeper place than in our heads. So what lies are lurking in my heart? I'm going to read just a few. In a moment, I'll put a QR code on the screen, and you can take away 50 lies that might reside in your heart. Some of you, if you've been around Burlington, will have done this before. But I just want to give you a feel for the way that this might work. So if I think whether God's always with me, I'm going to go yes. But if I ask, do I really believe, feel like God's always with me, then I'm not so sure. So do I feel is the question, not do I think. So, for example, do I feel God is distant and uninterested in me. Sometimes we feel that. Some of us might feel that a lot. Others of us might feel that less. But there's probably no one here who hasn't at some point in their life felt that God is distant from them. Are you with me? You reckon that's true? You might be the exception, but most people will relate to that. Do I feel that God is insensitive and uncaring? Sometimes we find ourselves in situations where we feel like God doesn't understand how hard it is being you or me. Have you ever felt like that? God doesn't quite understand? And the circumstances that he allows to go on around us confirm that he is sometimes insensitive and uncaring. Have you ever felt that God is stern and demanding? Have you ever felt that God loves other people more than you? Or to put that another way, have you ever felt that God answers someone else's prayers more readily than he answers your own? Which is one way of putting that. Do you feel that God is never satisfied with what you do? You've never quite made the grade. Do you feel that God's trying to take all the fun out of life? Yeah, I've sometimes felt that. Sunday school on a Sunday afternoon, flipping heck. Don't let the budgie out of the cage on a Sunday. Might enjoy himself. Can you see how this is beginning to work? So we're in our heads just going, no, that's not true, I don't believe that. But actually that's not the whole truth either. The lies reside in our hearts. And so what lies are lurking in my heart? If you want to pursue that this week, take a photograph of that QR code or grab the link. And that'll give you 50 of these to mull over. And they're themes, of course, but when we look at these in different ways, we can begin to see how there are ways of believing that are opposed to God's truth. I can always send that link, it's fine. So we need to be careful about what we allow to stay undetected in our hearts. If there is something that isn't true in our hearts, who are we aligning ourselves with? The enemy. The enemy. Jesus described the enemy as the father of... Whoa, hang about. Suddenly you can see how important it is, can't you? No wonder Proverbs said, guard your heart, for it's the wellspring of life. If in our hearts are things that are not true, we are giving the enemy a foothold in our hearts. So no wonder Paul said, don't give the enemy a chance, a foothold. And Jesus said, a heart or a house that's divided against itself cannot stand. And so here, right at the beginning of Genesis chapter 3, we are reminded that truth in our deepest places really matters. Often deception finds a home because of, second word, desire. The eyes that wanted more. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her and he ate it. Whose fault was that? Never has more ridiculous things been said about this verse in terms of whose fault it was. It was both their faults. powerful insight in this simple verse. A lie led to looking, and looking led to losing. And that's the way it works. That's the way temptation works the whole time. It begins with a lie, and because of the lie, they looked, and because they looked, they lost. Now, the order of things is really important. And what churches have tend to do and Christians have tend to do more often is to focus on the looking bit. You shouldn't eat that fruit, Adam and Eve, so don't look. And so we concentrate on doing the right thing. So looking was clearly the start of something wrong, so don't look. Now, obviously, that's got particular, for certain types of sin, looking is a particular problem. Greed and jealousy and so on come through the eyes, the Bible says. But the first thing, where it all begins, is the lie. So you have to deal with the lie and the looking in order to move yourself to a place of beating temptation. But let's look at this verse in a little bit more detail. The eyes that wanted more. There's incredible insight in just these few verses. And it's not Genesis 1:27. That's a mistake of mine. It's Genesis 3, verse 6 or 7, something like that. What number is it? 6. Top. Each phrase represents a layer of temptation. Good for food, the appeal to appetite, the physical impact of desire, the craving for something that promises to satisfy a hunger or a need. Now, interestingly enough, there's nothing wrong with that at one level. It's when we take it outside the boundaries of what's allowable. So eating an apple is a good gift from God. Eating that particular apple was not a good gift from God. It's when we say that the boundaries no longer apply to me or us, I will do whatever I choose. I will satisfy my physical desires however I choose. Good for food. Pleasing to the eye, the appeal to attraction, the pull of beauty or the pull of emotion or desire. It looks good. That's what advertising and consumerism works on all the time. It makes you feel like you want it. So you weren't hungry until you saw that picture of a Big Mac. No, it didn't really work, did it? But you weren't hungry until you saw that picture of... How many times have you talked about some food and I'm feeling quite hungry now? No, you weren't, but the desire, the deeper place, the emotion, the feeling has been triggered and you feel hungry because your desire has been awakened. And then the third level, desirable for gaining wisdom, the appeal to ambition. If I gain this knowledge, this wisdom, then somehow I will be able to control my own destiny. It's the belief of our own self-sufficiency, the belief of our own autonomy. I know what's best for me. And so we have this, the lie that we need to deal with. It's what we look at that we need to deal with, or what we focus on, or what we feast on. So pay attention to what you're looking at this week. Just think about it. Think about what desires are being awakened by what you look at. Now, if the lie isn't in place, just looking might be okay. But if the lie is lurking underneath and you're looking in the wrong place, then look out, you've probably already lost. So what do you spend your time feasting on? How harmless is that? How does it affect you? Does it make you, does it enhance the beauty of the life you're trying to live, or does somehow it detract away from it? As Paul would say to the Philippians, feast on whatever is wholesome. From memory, can you get it? I'm not sure I can. Wholesome, beautiful, honorable, Good. We'll take good. Praiseworthy. Thank you. Yeah, praiseworthy. It's like when you go out in the country and you feast on the beauty, something changes in your heart, right? That's not an accident, is it? You know? It's just, you can walk through an industrial estate, it doesn't do the same thing, right? It just doesn't. So pay attention to what you're looking at. And why is all this important? This is all important because the damage is massive. The break that changes everything, like a fault line that runs through the whole thing. Shame leads to hiding, leads to blaming, leads to them living under a curse. Shame, hiding, blaming, cursing is like a domino effect that goes through the rest of this chapter, right the way to the end. Shame, the inner collapse. It's all, notice that it's all about relationship. The first thing that goes wrong is their relationship with self. Second thing that went wrong was their relationship with God. Third thing that went wrong was their relationship with each other. The fourth thing that went wrong was their relationship with the whole of the created order. The whole thing collapses. Because that's what sin does. That's why it's so destructive and damaging and all the rest of it. Shame. Then the eyes of both of them were opened and they realized they were naked. Their eyes were open to what? To their shame. For the first time ever, their relationship with themselves was disrupted. They were in perfect harmony with themselves. Shame is when that harmony with yourself is disrupted. Let me ask you a question. Are you perfectly comfortable with yourself? I haven't met anybody perfectly comfortable with themselves. We do notice the power of someone who seems to be at peace with themselves. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know, there are some people that seem to achieve a beautiful comfortableness in their own skin. Yeah? But the reason that you notice those people is it's generally not the norm. And it's hard for us to grow. It's a whole journey of our own healing is to become comfortable in our, not with what's wrong, but comfortable in our own skin, in who we are. And so right at the get-go, as soon as they felt shame, there was this disconnect within them. And we've said this a few times. Notice that their response was not to hide the apple. That's important. Because when your kids do something wrong, they tend to hide what they've done wrong. They've drawn on the wall. Oh, hi. Yeah, or they've eaten something and they try and hide away the evidence of it. Adam and Eve tried to hide themselves. It wasn't just that they'd done something wrong. They discovered that they had become wrong. They were disconnected with themselves. And this is super important. And no amount of behavior now will help us reconnect with ourselves. This is a gift of God. No amount. And people spend all their lives trying to do the right thing to solve that disconnection. You can't do that. That's not how it gets resolved. It's shame. And then what happened? God comes walking towards them in the garden. And they hide from God among the trees of the garden. Shame is always hiding. We cover, we deny, we distract, we avoid. And so shame has led to hiding. And this is something we'll come back to in a minute. Notice this. I'm going to ask you a question in a minute. This will be part of the answer, right? So you're one up. When God rocks up, and he says to Adam, where are you? He wasn't asking for information. It was an invitation. Think about that. We'll come back to that in a minute. Blame. So they've fallen out with themselves. They're now fallen out with God and they're hiding from him. And then what's the next thing that happened? They blamed each other. Yeah, well, why not? Might as well complete the set. I'm no longer friendly with myself. I'm no longer friendly with God, so I'm no longer going to be friendly with you either. And that's what they did. And they started bickering with each other. You did it. It was your fault, my fault, whose fault? And blame. An inability to take responsibility. And hey, isn't that our human condition? Go back to the kids. It wasn't me. Blame. And blame led to this fault line going right the way through to the curse. The cosmic consequence. Cursed is the ground because of you. Sin doesn't fracture hearts only. It fractures creation. The whole thing went dark. Like a crack spreading through a stained glass window. So sin breaks everything. It breaks us, breaks our connection with God, our connection with self, others, and creation itself. Which of the above is grabbing your attention? Where do you see the effects of this right now in your own life? Is it that internal disconnection? I don't feel at ease with myself. We call that, for some people, a midlife crisis. It's not a midlife crisis. It's a crisis that's always been there. Just when you get to the middle of your life, you give it a bit of time because it's screaming at you. Because before then, you think, oh, I don't feel too right about myself, but actually, I'm about to take my A-levels. And when I get my A-level results, I'll feel good. Bad luck. And then when I get to university or I get my job, my first job, that'll do it. Or my first car or my first house or a spouse or a relationship and we keep going next time. When I get to the next plateau, then I'll no longer feel this dis-ease in my heart. And then we get all our ducks lined up as much as we feel like we're able to. Maybe we've got all the things we thought we would want to have, middle of life, and we're looking around and we're going, what next? And the reality begins to settle in that the things that we thought would solve that dis-ease just don't do it. That's what causes the crisis. But in reality, the crisis has been there the whole while. So you go out and you buy a sports car and it's all solved after that. So what is it, or where is it, that God's getting your attention right now? So is it that internal thing? Or is it the break in relationship with God? Actually, as you think about it, God seems distant today, right now. Is it that there's distance from someone else? That falling out with others. Adam and Eve started blaming each other. Are you critical, judgmental? Are you at odds with somebody? Are you not resolving something? Or is it just when you get up in the morning and work's hard and you think, flippin' heck, it was never meant to be like this. I need strength and resilience for the day because the ground is really tough right now where I have to work. That's a metaphor. I know you're not all working the ground, yeah? So the ground of your work, whatever that is really hard right now and you're suffering the curse of... Which of those four right now is the one that the Spirit of God would say, I'd love you to pay attention to that today. I'd love you to think about that, to explore that with me, to be curious about that, to go on a journey with me about that. Okay, final word. Who was listening at the beginning? What's the final word? Deliverance. Thank you very much. Deliverance. Sorry, that's the question for that one. Where do you see the effects of sin in your own life this week? Here we go. Deliverance. Grace still pursues. Arguably, Genesis chapter 3 is the most depressing, overwhelming, tragic chapter in the whole of the Bible. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, it couldn't get more depressing than this. We've had everything given to us, and we've totally screwed it up. Even in the most depressing, darkest, overwhelming, judgmental passage in the scriptures, there are at least five ways in which the grace of God still comes through. I'd like you to turn to the people around you, and I'd like you to try and find the five ways you think God's grace comes through in this chapter. Off you go. Okay, who's got one? Where's God's grace, even in the midst of this moment of tragedy? Yes? He made them close. Absolutely, he made them close. Genesis 3 and verse 21, there was a provision. God clothed Adam and Eve. And you'll have heard me say this before. How did he clothe them? Garments of skin. How do you get a garment of skin? Someone was sacrificed to clothe Adam and Eve. Does that ring any bells, anybody? A sacrifice that... Exactly. Yeah, okay, so great. So, that was the first one. Sorry, Liam, what were you saying? The promise, yep. So we've got a provision. God clothed Adam and Eve. We've got a promise. Verse 15, what was the promise? Who can read verse 15? Who can read verse 15 out loud? Different question. Who's willing and able to read verse 15 out loud? So there will be an offspring of Eve that will crush Satan's head. That's quite a promise, isn't it? Right back in the beginning of the Old Testament, there's a promise that someone in the line of Eve will crush Satan's head. Who was that? Great, just checking. It's not a squirrel, it's Jesus, yeah? It's Jesus. Jesus. The answer's Jesus, yeah? Jesus. Okay, so we've got the provision... we've got a promise and we've got provision. What else have we got? Yeah, beautiful. We got a pursuit. Pursuit. God came looking. God wasn't looking because he needed to know where they were. God wasn't fooled. God didn't go, oh, I've lost them. It wasn't like your kids in the shopping mall. You go, where are they? He didn't wander down to the usual spot and think they were missing. It was not about information, but it was an invitation. God, Adam, where are you? Adam, I need you to understand. The Bible says that God came walking in the cool of the day. A beautiful picture. So there was a pursuit. So we've got three. Let's see if we can wring two more out of this. Let's pretend our lives depend upon it. Absolutely. Part of that pursuit is super invitational. with them. You're absolutely right. And another one that's on a kind of different to the relational pursuit aspect I was thinking of. Yeah. Why do you think protection? You're just guessing because it's another P. Yeah, well done. That's good lateral thinking. Yeah, he got a B+ in his GCSE. He got the plus for being... Anyway, no, go on. Protection. Why? Where do you see the protection? Yes, that's part of it. Absolutely. Verses 22 to 24 I'm thinking about. So God introduces, he expels them from the garden and introduces effectively a protection in order to stop their eternal damnation. There's a protection right at the, we think, oh, a horrible God checking them out of the garden. That was a protection of them. That's how it's explained in Genesis 22:24 of chapter 3. And then finally, another P. He does pardon them, absolutely. We could have six then, couldn't we? We could keep going. This could be fun. The one I was thinking of was that there seemed to be, and it's tapping into what Anne-Marie said, there's kind of like a purposefulness with the way God dealt with them. You know when kids do something wrong, and it doesn't matter whether you're their parent or somebody else, and you're just angry about it, right? And you respond out of that anger. This is hypothetical. You'll never have done this, I know. This is just thinking outside the box, right? Imagine, and you're just angry. In that moment of punishment, there is no thought about the bigger picture, yeah? You're just angry, and they need to suffer because you're angry. You with me? Perhaps that's a bit strong, but you understand the sentiment, you know? I'm mad that you've done this, you know? But God's response isn't like that. The whole notion of Genesis chapter 3 is God bringing Adam and Eve to a place where they can come back. There's a purposefulness about God's dealing with them. Why do we see that in the bigger picture? We see that because in Ephesians chapter 1, it tells us when God made the plan to rescue humanity. When was it? What does it say in Ephesians chapter 1 about when God decided that he would rescue Adam and Eve and the rest of humanity? What's the phrase in Ephesians chapter 1? Before the foundation of the world. So God's got this plan because he knows what's going to happen. He's outside of the whole thing anyway. So God's whole dealing with Adam and Eve in these verses is because he has a plan. And this is perhaps a beautiful way to end, because we think that our sin is so often fatal. Our sin has created a context in which we're not sure how we can recover. And it's easy to put that on God, like God's somehow thwarted by what we've done wrong. Like God's plans are somehow totally out of kilter now. God's sitting in heaven going, I never thought you'd do that. I've no idea what to do now. Again, with human discipline, we might get to that point, don't we? I have no idea what to do now. But God's not like that. God, outside of the whole thing, has got even our mess-ups and our failure and our shame and our guilt and our passing the buck and our blaming other people. God's got all that in his hands of grace. So what does it mean this week to live intentionally in the grace of God? What it mean to live intentionally in the grace that God offers you? So think about, I said about those four, disconnected with self, disconnected with God, disconnected with others, and disconnected with creation. Which was the one that God drew your attention to 7 or 8 minutes ago? Which one was that? What would it be like in that space to be more intentional about receiving the grace of God? You see, so take the... My situation is really hard right now. My work is really difficult. I'm suffering under the curse. We can get up every day and bemoan that and fight against that. Or we can go, actually, God, your grace is for me, even in this. There's a world of difference between those two things. We can stay at odds with others with resentment or rejection or bitterness or pain. Or we can go, actually, God's grace is enough for all of this. I'm going to receive his grace because it's enough. Let's be quiet for a moment. Think of which of those areas God's drawing your attention to. Disconnect with self, disconnect with God, disconnect with others, disconnect with creation. And what would it mean to intentionally receive the grace of God in that place? We've walked through the shadows. Deception that clouds our vision. Desire that twists our hearts. Damage that leaves scars we cannot erase. And yet in the midst of it all, there is deliverance. God sees us. Not the masks we wear, not the regrets we carry, but the souls he loves. He calls us even this day out of hiding. He clothes our shame. He promises a future beyond our failings. So in this moment, we invite one another to bring it all to him. We hear him coming, walking towards us in the garden of our lives, inviting us. Simon, Alice, Katie, Barney, Chris, Jane, Tina, your name, where are you? We hear the invitation, and so we bring ourselves every longing, every fear, every broken piece of our story. I choose not to hide it, to justify it, or to carry it alone, but I lay it at his feet. To the God of deliverance. Knowing that my story doesn't end here. Doesn't end with my failing. But it begins with the God who restores. And so as you come walking to me today, I don't run and hide. But I hear your voice. And I come to meet you. Knowing that however hard and difficult and painful the truth is, it's also the place where I meet your grace. I thank you for what we now know, that you were so committed to dealing with our shame and cleansing our sin, that it wasn't just an animal sacrifice that you would use, but the death of your own son. And so I bring myself now.